This is VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Much has happened this past week, so spend some time with us as we review many of the stories that made up our daily VOA Asia program. Let's head back to last Sunday. My colleague Jim Stevenson was the host.
U.S. President Donald Trump is on his way to India to meet his counterpart, Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Both sides are already managing expectations by saying they will not be signing a big trade deal. Still, the visit will be full of pomp and circumstance, with Trump already touting the massive crowds expected to turn up for him. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Sawara takes a look at what we can expect in this meeting between leaders of the world's two most populous democracies.
India is sweeping its streets, scrubbing its landmarks, even building a wall to hide its slums in preparation for a visit from Donald Trump. The U.S. president is scheduled to arrive February 24th on a maiden two-day trip that aims to strengthen bilateral relations that have been strained by trade differences.
But I'm really saving the big deal for later on. We're doing a very big trade deal with India. We'll have it. I don't know if it'll be done before the election, but we'll have a very big deal with India.
Trump will likely announce several billion dollars in sales of American military hardware, but talks on a larger trade deal are complicated by issues including data privacy and e-commerce controls.
We would not like to rush into a deal, as the issues involved are complicated, and there are many decisions which actually could affect or impact the lives of millions of people.
Still, the visit is an opportunity for Trump and Prime Minister Narendra Modi, two populist leaders, to score domestic and international points.
For an Indian Prime Minister to have an American president come and visit, and for an American president who really does enjoy pomp and spectacle to say that a country which is one of the largest populations in this world is actually going to welcome him with open arms.
Last September, Trump showed up for Howdy Modi, an Indian diaspora event in Houston, Texas. The Prime Minister is returning the favor with a gathering at the world's biggest cricket stadium in his home state of Ahmedabad called Namaste Trump.
He told me we'll have 7 million people between the airport and the event.
Last year, Trump offered to mediate between India and neighboring Pakistan on the Kashmir territorial dispute, which Islamabad welcomed but Delhi rejected. Indian officials are wary the issue may come up again. Another potential complication, the U.S. effort to reach a peace deal with the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Taliban being allowed to come back into power is something India is not happy and not comfortable with. And in this, India's concern is that Pakistan may get a back entry into Afghanistan, and the U.S. deal may help Pakistan come back in.
This will be the fourth consecutive American president visit to India, continuing the shift in Washington's allegiance to Delhi over Islamabad. Patsy Whitaker-Sawara, VOA News at the White House.
South Korea has raised its alert level for the coronavirus disease to the highest level, and President Moon Jae-in urged officials not to hesitate to take unprecedented powerful measures to contain the outbreak. Korea's Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said of the 123 new cases reported Sunday, 113 were in the fourth largest city, Daegu, and surrounding areas. South Korea now has 556 reported coronavirus cases. Apart from the Diamond Princess cruise ship docked in Japan, South Korea has the most infections outside of China. China reported 648 new infections Sunday for a total of 76,936. It said 97 more people had died, raising the death toll in the country to 2,442. Outside China, more than 1,200 people have been infected with the virus and more than a dozen have died. Among the 11 million people under lockdown in the Chinese city of Wuhan, the epicenter of the new coronavirus, is Kristen Chiao, a Springfield, Virginia student. She's been stuck in China since visiting with her family in Wuhan during the Lunar New Year holidays. Now, her school is stepping in for help. For VOA, Yunjun Cho tells us more.
The answer is wrong.
Students are hard at work solving logarithmic equations at this high school in Springfield, Virginia. At first glance, it's like any other classroom across America. But look carefully, and you'll see a tripod with an iPad mounted on top, following the teacher's movement. This technology is what allows Kristen Hsiao to join her class remotely from Wuhan, China, ground zero of the coronavirus outbreak.
First time when I heard about acceleration.
This graph. You said this one, first time.
Kristen Hsiao was visiting her family in Wuhan in China's Hubei province for the Lunar New Year holidays. With the entire city under lockdown to contain the spread of the new coronavirus, Kristen's plan to return to her school in Virginia is now on hold indefinitely. So Kristen connects to her classes live online from 9 p.m. to midnight in Wuhan.
This incident in Wuhan, it gave me a lot of study pressure. So I was already in 11th grade. So my time is very tense.
That's where the technology can help, says the school's superintendent.
As a school, we were looking for an opportunity to be able to facilitate learning while she's in China, so that way she's just not sitting at home doing nothing. And we wanted her to be part of our school, so we kind of brainstormed and developed a system using a piece of hardware that's called Swivel. It allows the student to be live in the classroom.
Kristen recently sent a video message to her school asking to send much-needed medical aid to hospitals in Wuhan. Her fellow students and faculty moved quickly and raised $30,000 in just a week.
I want to put out my heart to them because I don't know what they're going through. I don't know their fears. And from what I can see in China right now, it's very scary. People aren't allowed to leave their homes, and it's something that we don't experience in America.
It really does hit home that this isn't just something affecting one part of the world. This coronavirus is affecting everyone, and we need to help as much as possible.
The school is working with an international aid agency, Hungarian Baptist Aid, to send assistance to Wuhan. Officials say they'll be sending special respiratory masks and contactless thermometers to Wuhan Central Hospital and the Hubei Children's Medical Center in the next 10 days. The students and the parents are hoping the aid they send will help shore up the much-needed medical aid in Wuhan, the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak. Eun Jung Cho, VOA News, Washington.
As Afghanistan grapples with the possibility of a peace deal, the future of millions of Afghan refugees also looks a little more hopeful. United Nations and other officials at a refugee conference in Pakistan warn that peace alone will not be enough to send them home. VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports from Islamabad.
Trucks, cars, wagons full of household goods, pots, pans, beds, and the clothes they could carry. War forced millions to flee Afghanistan over the last four decades. 95% moved to neighboring Iran and Pakistan. None intended to stay long. Now, a third generation of Afghans is living outside their homeland. Host countries are struggling for resources, and international donor aid is scarce.
Emergencies coming up elsewhere, even in this own region. We have the Rohingya situation, for example. So donor communities or donor governments tend to look at the most compelling emergencies, and the protracted refugee situations tend to lose out.
Many Rohingya fled violence in Myanmar. The United States and Taliban are close to signing a peace deal in Doha. Soon after, the Taliban will begin formal negotiations with a group representing other Afghan factions. If all goes well, it could mean an end to the long-running conflict and an opportunity for the refugees to go back home.
I am cautiously optimistic that we've made progress. It's a very complicated problem, no doubt.
Twice before, Afghan refugees returned home in large numbers. Once after the fall of the Soviet Union and again after the fall of the Taliban. Both times, conditions on the ground forced them to leave their homeland again. A successful refugee repatriation will require a lot more than an end to the war, says the head of the UN Refugee Agency.
Immediately after peace, if peace comes, there needs to be massive investment in economic opportunities, in infrastructure, in other areas of development.
Without such investment, the fate of the refugees and of Afghanistan itself remain uncertain. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
As VOA Asia continues, each year in Pakistan, drivers throw down a challenge to meet in the desert for sun-scorched immortality. They ride custom-built 4x4s in an off-road race that draws hundreds of thousands of spectators. VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports a living legend once again stepped onto the gas and tore through the sand.
Recently, in Pakistan's Cholistan Desert, more than 130 cars churned up clouds of sand in an annual race before the dust-filled eyes of 500,000 spectators. Drivers raced against a living legend.
Cholistan is a 24,000-square-kilometer desert in which there is hardly a place where people do not know Rani Patel. This is a matter of great honor and pride for me, and it gives me great pleasure.
Rani Patel won the first Desert Jeep Rally in 1994. Decades later, despite placing in the top three at each rally, he says winning trophies doesn't get his motor running.
All the respect, all the love, all the recognition I've earned is because of this sport. It's what keeps me going.
But custom cars are expensive, which for a time left lower budget racers in the garage. Not anymore, says Patel.
We introduced a stock category that isn't for the rich. It's for people who want to race their regular cars, and participation doesn't cost much.
About 500,000 people came to this rally. But for Patel, the race can grow and deserves a bigger track.
Jeep rallies have a bright future in Pakistan. With proper management, it could become huge. It's already gone international.
Fans of the race love the setting as much as the action.
We came with our friends to watch this Jeep rally, and we're having a great time. It's exciting, but it looks difficult. It's amazing how they drive these cars. Dust flying to the skies and literally covering people's faces.
Despite its name, the days-long rally is open to more than just Jeeps. The race was suspended for 10 years starting in 1995 because of security concerns in Pakistan. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg was a major target of his Democratic rivals in his first debate last week in Las Vegas, Nevada. Bloomberg has already had a major impact on the race by spending hundreds of millions of dollars on TV ads and has shot into second place in some national public opinion polls behind Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who was the winner of the Nevada caucuses on Saturday. Bloomberg now finds himself in a crowd of moderates all trying to be the main alternative to Sanders, a self-described Democratic socialist who has strong support from the progressive wing of the party. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
In the latest Democratic debate broadcast by NBC News, former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg walked into the political equivalent of the lion's den.
I'd like to talk about who we're running against, a billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg.
Leading the charge was Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Look, I'll support whoever the Democratic nominee is, but understand this. Democrats take a huge risk if we just substitute one arrogant billionaire for another.
Also eager to pile on Bloomberg was the front runner, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
We are giving a voice to people who are saying we are sick and tired of billionaires like Mr. Bloomberg seeing huge expansions of their wealth while 500,000 people sleep out on the street tonight.
Bloomberg tried to make the case that he could unite Democrats and take on President Trump in November.
I think we have two questions to face tonight. One is, who can beat Donald Trump? And number two, who can do the job if they get into the White House? And I would argue that I am the candidate that can do exactly both of those things.
On the economy, a unique leader, Mike Bloomberg's created over 400,000 jobs.
Bloomberg has spent hundreds of millions of dollars to promote himself as a centrist alternative to Sanders. But his wealth and late entry into the race have also made him a Sanders target.
We are are a democracy, not an oligarchy. You're not going to buy this election.
Let me finish. Thank you.
Bloomberg's strategy is to exploit the uncertainty in the Democratic race, says analyst Jim Kessler.
His candidacy was really contingent on there being a muddled race. There's a muddled race. So if you look at the chessboard right now, which he has no control over, the pieces on the chessboard have moved in probably the most advantageous way it is for him.
Thank you.
Bloomberg presents himself as a moderate alternative in the Democratic race, but he has plenty of company, says Julie Pace.
A Joe Biden, Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, who are really looking to break out of that moderate lane, he's actually making that lane much more crowded by getting in the race at this stage.
Having skipped the early contest, Bloomberg is counting on a strong performance in the 14 primaries being held on Super Tuesday, March 3rd, says analyst John Fortier.
He hasn't really faced the scrutiny of the other candidates. I think he might have a place to put his flag on, but we don't know. And so I think the possibility is there because of his money, because of the spending he's done, and yet we don't know that he will stand up to scrutiny of the other candidates.
Bloomberg will continue to bombard the airwaves with ads, but his rivals are sure to raise questions about his viability after a rocky performance in his first debate. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
It seems inevitable that in this era of smart technology, people would begin to think of ways to make their tech part of their body. Today, people have the ability to change themselves in new and unprecedented ways, and a 19-year-old Kyle Andre is living proof. Anna Nelson has the story narrated by Anna Rice.
Action.
My name is Kyle Andre, and I am a cyborg.
Cyborgs is short for cybernetic organisms. It's a fancy name for a thing that's part machine, part human. Today, the 19-year-old Kyle Andre is being followed by a camera crew. A movie about the teenage cyborg from Barcelona is in the making. Landre has a special chip that will be implanted on his skull and another one in his arm that allow him to sense the cosmic rays that surround us and convert them into musical notes. The Princeton University invited the young man to come to New York City to give a speech and explain what it means to be a cyborg.
I was so excited for being there. I was so excited being able to present the cosmic sense for the first time. So I went to Princeton to present this prototype and also to talk about cyborg art.
Landre was born in 2000, and for him, high-tech has always meant much more than laptops and smartphones. He got interested in space exploration and quantum physics, and later fell in love with music.
So I started creating musical atmospheres and actually released an album that is space and everything like that.
A meeting with Neil Harbison, a Spanish-born British-Irish cyborg artist and activist, became the next important step in Landre's life. Since birth, Harbison couldn't distinguish colors. But after he became the world's first cyborg and had an antenna implanted in his skull, he learned to see color, thanks to a special chip that reads the color of objects to the brain. Together with a few like-minded people, Harbison founded the Cyborg Foundation.
They asked me if I wanted to create a cyborg sense, and I said yes, and they took me to the Cyborg Labs, the Cyborg Foundation, and I could see everything they had created, and we did an activity that Neil proposed, that it was creating a timeline of all my life, divided by the different years I had lived. And so I would put one memory to each year, and then I would see if there was any pattern repeating.
At the moment, Kai is wearing a prototype of the chip that will be implanted in his skull, which will make him the first person to directly receive signals from space converted into sounds.
It's like hearing a light particle touching. My sense is like, so it works this way. This is the receptor, and this is the receptor of cosmic rays. So in this chip, we find different parts. This part is a silicon photomultiplier, which is basically a chip that receives light particles. And what we do is we receive the light particle, the subatomic light particles that are created when cosmic rays fall into our planet. and it receives these subatomic particles, one particle for each ray, and it translates with this Arduino, which is right here, it translates each cosmic ray by energetic density into a different pitched note. It's mostly beautiful. I love being able to hear space.
Landry says he is ready for this experience. He believes it is part of human evolution, part of exploring nature instead of conquering and destroying it. For Anna Nelson in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
You are listening to VOA Asia Weekend.
The World Health Organization says the coronavirus outbreak does not yet fit the criterion for a pandemic, but it does warn a pandemic is possible. A nation should prepare. There are now more than 77,000 cases of the virus in China and more than 2,000 elsewhere. The overall death toll stands at over 2,600. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The sudden surge of coronavirus cases in South Korea, Iran, and Italy over the past few days has sent a shiver through the world and created fears that what had been an epidemic is now becoming a pandemic. The World Health Organization is urging people to calm down. WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says the virus has a potential for becoming a pandemic, but that time is not yet here.
Our decision about whether to use the word pandemic to describe an epidemic is based on an ongoing assessment of the geographical spread of the virus, the severity of disease it causes, and the impact it has on the whole society.
For the moment, he says none of this can be seen. He says this is not a pandemic, but a series of epidemics in different parts of the world, requiring a tailored response to contain the spread of the disease. Tedros agrees that the sudden surge of new cases in South Korea, Iran, and Italy is very concerning. But he notes giving into an unfounded fear will not prevent a single infection of this respiratory illness, nor save a single life.
We must focus on containment while doing everything we can to prepare for a potential pandemic. There is no one size fits all approach. Every country must make its own risk assessment for its own context.
The WHO chief says his agency continues to do its own risk assessment and is monitoring the evolution of the epidemic around the clock. He says there are several crucial measures countries should take to protect themselves and their people. All countries, he says, must protect health workers who are the frontline responders of this deadly disease. Additionally, he says steps must be taken to protect the elderly with underlying health conditions who are most at risk of becoming seriously ill. On a brighter note, Tedros says international experts investigating the origin and evolution of the disease in China find that the epidemic there peaked and plateaued between January 23rd and February 2nd. Since then, they say cases have been declining steadily. The experts say there has been no change in the DNA of the virus, and the fatality rate in China's Wuhan province, the epicenter of the disease, is between 2 and 4%. Outside Wuhan, it is less than 1%. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Clusters of the virus continue to emerge outside of China, including South Korea, where President Moon Jae-in placed the country under a red alert. That's the highest level alert level. Iran says 12 people have died of the virus in that country. In Italy, where 219 people have tested positive for the virus and 5 have died, police manned checkpoints around a dozen quarantined northern towns as worries grew across Europe. South Korean schools closed and major events, including concerts and the opening of the top Korean football league, were indefinitely postponed Monday as that country attempted to limit the spread of the coronavirus. The country has reported over 800 infections in the past week, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
The center of South Korea's coronavirus outbreak is the southeastern city of Daegu, where authorities urged residents to stay home. Many businesses closed. On Monday, at a large department store that did open, a long line of customers snaked around the building. They're trying to buy face masks, which in some cases have shot up in price. masks and other emergency supplies have sold out of many stores in Seoul, which has reported a smaller surge in infections. One resident in Seoul's Jongno district says she's stockpiled face masks and says she's looking to buy hand sanitizer. She says she thinks the outbreak will last a long time. South Korea saw a spike in coronavirus infections starting last week. The outbreak has raised concerns the virus is spreading outside China, where it originated, and may turn into a global pandemic. Authorities here have undertaken a massive public health campaign. Residents receive emergency text message alerts when they go near locations that have been visited by a coronavirus-infected patient. The government sends out several alerts per day in English and Korean, detailing the latest infection cases. Many major office buildings use thermal cameras to monitor the temperature of people who enter. Signs on sidewalks, buses, and at train stations encourage residents to use proper hygiene. Many businesses are providing hand sanitizer. There are concerns the outbreak could hurt South Korea's economy, which had already been growing slowly. South Korea's stock market ended down almost 4% Monday. Some major South Korean companies have been forced to temporarily halt or reduce production due to a shortage of parts from China, where many factories have closed. Local businesses are also hurting from an apparent reduction in tourism. At a streetside stand in Seoul's tourist area of Myeongdong, a vendor is selling a sweet red bean-filled pastry. He says his sales have plummeted by about two-thirds, and that he estimates it will take at least 6 months for the economy to recover. The outbreak also threatens to become a sensitive political issue just weeks ahead of an important legislative election. Many conservative and other critics have urged the government to tighten restrictions on the entry of people from China. An editorial in the conservative Chosun Ilbo compared the government's virus containment efforts to trying to catch flies with the windows wide open. But South Korean authorities have rejected those demands, noting the virus has now begun spreading locally among people with no links to China. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Authorities in northern Italy have banned tourism and have ordered closures of many public places in Lombardy and Veneto provinces to stop the spread of the coronavirus, which has killed at least three and infected at least 152 people in the country. VOA's Lada Sahok reports Italy now has the highest number of confirmed coronavirus cases in Europe.
The popular Venice Carnival ended Sunday, 2 days ahead of schedule, with some people questioning the decision.
It is useless to stop a carnival because there are hospitals and bars and supermarkets and restaurants and trains and planes and ferries, which are all open spaces. So how do you solve this problem? Stopping a carnival? It's all ridiculous.
About 50,000 people cannot enter or leave several towns in Veneto and Lombardy for the next 2 weeks without special permission. Police have been deployed to ensure compliance with the order. Even outside the two provinces, many businesses and schools have suspended activities. Sporting events have been canceled until March. Italy's celebrity designer Giorgio Armani presented his new collection behind the closed doors. But the northern town of Ivrea kept its doors open to thousands of visitors who attend the annual Battle of Oranges, which is the highlight of Ivrea's carnival season.
For sure, a carnival like this one that brings so many tourists, you could say is problematic. On the other hand, to block such an event with 15,000 people taking part brings other problems.
But the mayor of Ivrea said public health comes first, and the carnival will be suspended if the government orders it.
In total, the people infected are 152 at the moment and three dead. As you know, there was a person in intensive care who died in hospital in Cremona a few minutes ago. The numbers region by region are Lombardy has 110, Veneto has 21, and Emilia-Romagna there are 9 and 2 in Lazio.
The source of the coronavirus outbreak in Italy is still being investigated. A businessman who had recently returned from China tested negative for the virus. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
The economic effects of the deadly coronavirus sent global stock and oil prices plunging Monday, while the infectious disease forced China to postpone its annual legislative session and pose some new health threats across the world. Key stock indexes in the U.S. plummeted about 3% in afternoon trading in New York, following sharper losses in European markets and more modest drops at Asia's top exchanges. A day after Chinese President Xi Jinping called the infectious disease a crisis that would hurt the country's economy, Beijing said the National People's Congress would not meet as scheduled on March 5th. A new legislative start date would be decided later, they said. U.S. President Donald Trump said Monday that India will always hold a special place in our hearts as he and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi praised each other in addresses before a crowd of more than 100,000 people who gathered for a welcome Trump rally in the city of Ahmedabad. The event was part of a 36-hour visit Trump is making to the country, one he noted in his speech involving an 8,000-mile trip. Voice of America's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman is on the trip, and he joins us now. Steve, how do things go on this first day of the trip?
Well, the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, really put on a big show for the visiting U.S. president. There was a big event at a new cricket stadium in Ahmedabad, where perhaps as many as 100,000 people were there to hear both of the leaders speak. But there was a really kind of a festival on the road for the Trump motorcade from the airport to this stadium, where tens of thousands of people line the streets, some of them singing and dancing. There was people dressed in traditional Indian folk costumes and performing traditional music, and a lot of people cheering and waving Indian and American flags. It was really a spectacle and probably the biggest crowd that President Trump has ever witnessed anywhere cheering for him.
What is President Trump hoping to get out of this, and what is Mr. Modi hoping to get out of this visit?
Well, the first day of the visit definitely was very much an emphasis on style, boosting the images of both leaders in their respective countries. On the second day, there will be a little bit of substance. The president is going to announce a helicopter deal, a sale of U.S. helicopters to the Indian military worth several billion dollars. We understand there'll be several memoranda of understanding signed, but the President of the United States is not getting the big trade deal that he had originally hoped to sign on this trip when the two leaders first talked about it. I asked the president on Air Force One today on our short flight from Ahmedabad to Agra about that and whether there was any single contentious sector that was holding up the deal, and he responded he was in no rush to conclude a trade pact and said we're doing very well with India and we are making deals, but obviously he's not making this one very big deal that he had hoped for.
Has there been, or do you expect to have or see or cover any discussion between the two leaders over the very controversial Indian immigration plan?
Sure. There is that issue as well as the matter of Kashmir as well. We have been told that these issues will come up in private. Now, the two leaders are expected to appear before the media together on Tuesday. As far as I know, President Modi has not really answered any questions in public from reporters since he's been prime minister. But there are some indications that the president will perhaps stick around and answer some questions from the many, many reporters who are here, as he tends to do on these foreign trips. And most certainly, if there's more than just one or two questions, and certainly if the Indian reporters get to ask some questions, the subject of that citizenship law, as well as Kashmir, will most likely come up.
There has been a lot written and reported about similarities between Trump and Modi. What are they, and do they respect each other for that?
Well, they are both most definitely nationalists who put their own countries first, definitely how they position everything that they're doing. And, of course, both leaders have been seen as taking a hard line against Muslims in terms of immigration, part of what this citizenship law is all about. But there is no doubt that these two men have very, very good personal chemistry between themselves and respect each other, despite their very different backgrounds and how they came to power. Modi, coming from a humble background, as Trump noted during the stadium rally today, started out working at a tea stand, while, of course, President Trump inherited money and real estate from his father and turned that into becoming one of the most prominent people in New York City, if not the country, and then as a political novice on his first try for political office, winning the presidency.
Was there an effort on India's part to gather huge crowds, especially at this new stadium, and maybe lining streets, or is this a natural reaction from the Indian people?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. There's no doubt that this was an organized event. They had little stands set up along the motorcade route where different types of folk dances from different states were featured. So there is some amount, a great amount, actually, of coordination that went into this. But I can tell you, we were in the motorcade and passing these people who were cheering and smiling. It wasn't like in some totalitarian country where, you know, they didn't have a choice but to be out there and were putting their best face forward despite the situation. These people were truly excited to see the president. I was way back in Press Van 3, which was probably about the 20th vehicle in the motorcade, and they were still cheering and waving at us. So that gives you some degree of the amount of enthusiasm that this crowd had during this very exciting Monday.
Voice of America's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. He is on the trip with President Trump to India. Thank you so much, Steve. The week was rounded out in the capable hands of VOA Asia's Doug Bernard.
Well, the preliminaries are over, and the 2020 Democratic presidential hopefuls are off to the races. And as they say in the biz, the track is fast. VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone joins us now. Jim, we have, it seems like, everything coming up all at once. Tuesday night, there's going to be a debate between the Democratic hopefuls. And then on Saturday, there's going to be a Democratic primary in South Carolina. What are the importance of, less so the debate, and more this primary? And who does it matter to?
Well, the South Carolina primary probably is a make-or-break test for former Vice President Joe Biden. Biden has long been relying on the support of African-American voters. They're a big constituency in South Carolina for Democrats. If he cannot basically win that race, and hopefully convincingly, he may have some problems moving ahead. Bernie Sanders has a lot of momentum right now. He's mm-hmm. won the first three contests. The last contest in Nevada, he had a huge margin of victory. So the Democratic moderates, Biden among them, Michael Bloomberg, et cetera, have to find a way to slow him down.
You know, I'm used to candidates getting a bounce out of a early contest, say out of Iowa or New Hampshire or maybe even Nevada. How much of a bounce is it possible to have out of South Carolina when just a few days later on Tuesday, it's quote unquote Super Tuesday, and a massive cache of delegates are going to be awarded.
Like more than 1,300 on that one day, 14 states holding primaries. No, you're right, Doug. Even if Biden, say, were to get somewhat of a bounce out of South Carolina, how much would it help him? Don't forget, under our system, too, places like California and other states, some of them are already voting. They vote early by mail, so they're not susceptible to the late changes in the race. And again, Bernie Sanders seems well-positioned to do better in a lot of these states than many of his competitors right now. But I think that's why this Tuesday debate is important, to see if moderates can land some blows on Bernie Sanders and at least try to slow down the momentum, because right now he's running away with the field.
We keep hearing some in the chattering class saying that there's a Bernie panic going on right now among Democrats, the Democratic field, and the Democratic Party at large. Is it possible that we might start seeing a number of candidates drop out after South Carolina or after Super Tuesday, kind of clearing the field for more of a one-on-one contest?
Well, it seems more likely after Super Tuesday if people like Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, and some of the others, Tom Steyer, don't register some strong showings in some states. What is their reason to continue on? So, yes, I think that is a possibility. I do think that the kind of mainstream leadership of the Democratic Party is befuddled at the moment. This is completely out of their hands. And we are looking at a situation: has the party moved further left than party leaders have even realized? And I think as the Sanders train keeps going on, that question will become louder. And is there enough time at this point to even rally around one moderate alternative to Bernie Sanders? Michael Bloomberg will have a lot to show in the Tuesday debate. His first debate performance was very weak, and he needs to have something to build on the money he spent in all those Super Tuesday contests.
And finally, just to be clear for our listeners, there is no mechanism in the Democratic Party for party leaders to sort of, you know, tell people to get out of the race, get out of the way.
No, that's right. It's up to them, and their money usually dries up. But in this case, they've been able to fundraise off the internet, so some of them are hanging in.
We will see. VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone, and we have complete campaign coverage at voanews.com. Rights activists in Hong Kong and abroad on Tuesday denounced a Chinese court's decision to sentence former Hong Kong bookseller Guai Minhai to 10 years in prison on charges of illegally providing intelligence to foreign entities. The 55-year-old was a Swedish national based in Hong Kong, where he sold books critical of China's political leadership. Mainland police seized him in 2018 on a Beijing-bound train in the presence of Swedish diplomats. Amnesty International China researcher Patrick Poon suggested that because of the focus on COVID-19, Gui's sentencing would garner little attention.
Because his case is so famous, and everyone is so concerned about the case, because it's not just an ordinary case about freedom of expression. It's also about how a foreign national could be treated, not just on Chinese soil, but also outside.
A spokesman for China's foreign ministry said that Gui's rights and interests have been fully guaranteed. Swedish Foreign Minister Anna Linde said that they have not seen either the indictment or any information about it beforehand, and were not able to provide assistance.
We continue to ask for the immediate release of the Swedish citizen Gui Minhai, and also to get consular access and for a Swedish doctor to be able to visit Gui Minhai.
A statement from the court in Ningbo said Gui would not be appealing the sentence, and he has asked to have his Chinese citizenship reinstated. His daughter and supporters have called for his release, saying he's a victim of illegal political persecution. Gui is the highest of five booksellers who disappeared between October and December in 2015, all linked to a Hong Kong bookshop famous for its gossipy texts on Chinese political leaders. U.S. President Donald Trump says that he's optimistic about the prospects of a trade deal with India. Trump met Tuesday in New Delhi with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi as he wrapped up his two-day visit to India. For more, our Steve Miller spoke with VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman, who's traveling with the president.
Well, we've heard a lot from the president himself about this, and I think the way you can summarize his 36 hours here is that there was a lot of talk about trade, but no big deal. And both sides are optimistic that eventually they will reach a conclusion and create some gigantic trade deal. At least that's the way that President Trump views it. There was the expected announcement about the completion of an agreement for India to buy helicopters and some other military equipment from the United States. That's worth about $3 billion. And I think we can see more of that ahead because both Prime Minister Modi and President Trump said that they were looking at expanding cooperation on counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and maritime security. Trump calling the relationship with India now truly stronger than ever before.
Any indication from the White House on when the next round of talks may commence to get around to that?
Well, according to both President Trump and Prime Minister Modi, they are talking. I have also been speaking to officials both from the Indian government and the U.S. government, and they're essentially blaming each other for the lack of a deal during the time that the president visited. The Indians felt that the Americans were really pushing them and that the Indians didn't want to have this visit come off without the deal being announced. But the Indian view was they're in no hurry, and that language has also been echoed by President Trump himself when I asked him on Air Force One on Monday about what was the holdup on it. And so there's a lot of speculation, especially among the analysts, that from this point on, it's going to be a slow and careful process. And we may not see anything until after the November presidential election, very similar to the much-touted Phase 2 U.S.-China trade agreement.
That was VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Also today, at least 10 people were killed, about 130 injured in clashes between opposing groups in the Indian capital. It was the deadliest riots in the city since protests against a new citizenship law began approximately 2 months ago. India's capital has been a hotbed of protests against the new Citizenship Amendment Act, which eases the path of non-Muslims from three neighboring Muslim-dominated countries to gain Indian citizenship. You're listening to VOA Asia. The growing spread of the coronavirus has rattled stock markets, with indexes experiencing sharp losses in every continent. Authorities in China and other hard-hit countries have enforced lockdowns that have paralyzed production, interrupted supply chains, and disrupted tourism and other key service sectors. VOA's Ardita Dunalari examines risks to the global economy if the coronavirus becomes a pandemic, as some health experts fear it might.
Stock markets from the United States to Asia and Europe have been hit hard as health authorities confirm new pockets of coronavirus infection from the Middle East to Europe.
The market is now coming to recognize that this epidemic has far from peaked. It now looks like it's spreading, and it's going to be causing a lot of disruptions to global supply chains, to the travel industry, to tourism, to a whole lot of things.
Coronavirus has triggered widespread fear and increasingly severe reactions from authorities in scores of countries, imposing lockdowns with paralyzing effects on commerce, especially in China, the world's second largest economy.
What we have in China is a situation where 150 million people are locked down. You know, so these people who went home for the vacation, for the New Year vacation, they now can't return to work.
As companies feel the impact, so too will consumers.
We're going to see real economic impacts
from this outbreak. We've already seen it, for example, when Apple says that there's going to be a palpable impact on its ability to produce iPhones in the near term.
Some believe the economic impact will be intense but short-lived. Analyst Mark Hamrick likens coronavirus to a hurricane. Once it passes, recovery begins and activity gradually returns to normal.
For investors who are only focused on the short term, these are very real impacts. For investors who are focused on the intermediate and long terms, they're going to look beyond this and say, we will live to invest and fight another day.
But researcher Desmond Lochman believes the impact on China will be more long-lasting, with companies looking to diversify their supply chains so they can be less reliant on China in the future.
Companies will draw lessons from this experience. You know, my expectation is that this will be a drain on the Chinese economy long term. It's not going to look that attractive for foreign investment.
Coronavirus won't be the last economically disruptive pathogen to spread across borders and continents. The question, analysts say, is what lessons nations and companies draw from the outbreak and whether the global economy becomes more resilient to future shocks. Ardita Dunelari, VOA News, Washington.
Every year, around 12 million tons of plastic waste are dumped into the world's oceans. But now a group of fishermen in Barcelona, Spain, have begun an innovative new project in which they're given financial support to catch plastic. Henry Ridgewell reports.
5 o'clock on a cold February morning. Carlos Martin and his crew steer the Bonamar II out of Barcelona's port into the dark waters of the Mediterranean. Year by year, the job is getting tougher. Plunging stocks mean the nets are no longer stuffed with fish. Increasingly, it's plastic waste that's being hauled on board. Martin says, I put it down to the rivers that carry a lot of garbage. More plastic accumulates near the mouths of the rivers. Martin sails further from the shore to avoid the waste, further adding to his costs. We separate the solid plastic and we bring it back to land, he says, but the cellulose plastic gets hooked onto the knots of the nets. So when it's wet and caked with mud, this adds extra weight to the fishing nets. The net does not function properly in relation to its height in the water, and it takes on mud, causing the net to break because it weighs so much. The local government has come up with a novel solution. The fishermen will become the front line in the battle against ocean plastics. Initially, 1 million euros of taxpayers' money from the European Union and the Catalan government will support dozens of fishermen like Martin. They won't receive any money, but instead practical measures to help them haul in the plastic waste. Sergi Tudela is General Director of Catalonia Fisheries.
With these funds, they can improve what they need to carry on board in order to, you know, the boxes or all the facilities they need in order to cope with the problem. And then, of course, at the same time, to characterize, to carry out studies to characterize the origin, the specificities of this marine litter. We are hopeful that if we are successful in this project, right, that this project could be replicated in other areas in the Mediterranean.
The amount of plastic waste on Spanish beaches has grown by 65% in just 6 years, according to government figures. Martin says the fishing community now understands the scale of the problem. Before, we didn't see it that way, he says. We took it and threw it back into the water. We had no conscience. I think that in a few years here, we have become very aware. Nothing is thrown into the water. We collect everything and bring it back to shore. Abandoned fishing gear makes up a big proportion of the estimated 8 to 12 million tons of plastic that are dumped into the world's oceans every year. Martin and his fishing community are determined to change the industry's image and be part of the global effort to clean up our oceans. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News.
World Health Organization now reports that there are about 81,000 confirmed cases of the COVID-19 virus around the globe. But for the first time, the number of new cases outside of China is greater than the new cases in China. At least 78,190 cases have been found in China, with 2,718 deaths. There are now at least 2,790 cases in 37 countries and 44 deaths outside of China, where the disease was first identified. The coronavirus outbreak continues to spread, with infections in 33 countries, the latest being reported in Afghanistan, Bahrain, Iraq, and Oman. Gary Hufbauer is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He spoke to VOA's Steve Miller and told him that while stock markets plunging are getting a lot of attention, that's not what he's watching to determine how healthy the global economy really is.
The most specific two things I'm looking for are, one, a reliable test that can detect before a person has developed antibodies whether that person has been is now carrying the coronavirus. We do not have that test now. Secondly, I'm looking for a vaccine that can be administered to people to protect them, as we use vaccines against flu, to protect them against the coronavirus. We do not have that vaccine now. So I'm not actually looking at economic indicators. I'm looking at health indicators, because the current spotty evidence suggests that a person can be a carrier without showing much symptoms for up to 30 days. And what that means is that we've got carriers going all over the world and exposing people, which has approximately a 2% mortality rate. That is very scary, because what it means in economic terms is that governments, without these two tests, without those, what governments are going to do is all kinds of quarantine measures, which interrupt all supply chains that you can imagine, as we've seen in extreme cases in China and in South Korea.
Now, let me follow up on that really quickly, because, yeah, you know, speaking at the WHO on Tuesday, they said one of the, you know, things that China did correctly was institute some of these quarantines and movement restriction policies to try and reduce and limit the spread of disease. Now, if we take a look at the quarantine on the Diamond Princess, which was the vessel that was docked in Yokohama, Japan, and how that spread among the people on board the ship there, and presumably, however, the virus is being spread in the city of Wuhan, which is the epicenter of this, you know, as people continue to travel, as the incubation period appears to be somewhere along a month, you know, you have all this uncertainty. And is that the uncertainty that we're seeing now reflected in the market as the number of cases continues to grow up? And, you know, governments are now saying, hey, we need to, you know, take more money out of our budgets and give it to preventative measures. And as companies are starting to miss some of their key deadlines because of supply chain, you know, restrictions and, you know, reductions in the follow through of goods?
Oh, absolutely. We're seeing all that, because without the tests and the vaccine, which I mentioned, the only thing governments can do is interrupt interactions between people. And that means, you know, halting airlines. It means a lot of precautions before the sailors board a, you know, a container vessel, because, you know, if they get the coronavirus in the middle of the Pacific, that's not good for moving that vessel. You know, ports where you get a lot of people working together, you're worried about that. So that's all that government can do, is interrupt interaction between people. And what is the economy? Well, it's basically interaction between people, but also interactions over the internet. So you do have both. But the interaction between people have been, seriously limited in some countries, and they will be limited in more countries until, you know, a more targeted approach can be devised.
Gary Huffbauer with the Peterson Institute for International Economics, speaking with our Steve Miller.
In Washington, I'm Ira Melman. This has been VOA Asia Weekend. You're invited to join us for next week's edition. And remember to stay up to the minute in this changing world by checking our website at voanews.com, along with our many social media platforms.